This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic and actor Aziz Ansari, is one of the stars of the NBC series Parks and Recreation. In the Judd Apatow film Funny People, he played a loud and self-satisfied comic named Randy, a character Aziz has revived in his own stand-up act. Ansari has also been in the films Observe and Report and I Love You, Man, and has made guest appearances on Flight of the Conchords and Scrubs. He was a member of Human Giant, which had its own sketch comedy show on MTV. But if you want a full dose of Aziz Ansari, there's a new stand-up special he did for Comedy Central, which is now on DVD and CD. It's called Intimate Moments for a Sensual Evening. Ansari grew up in South Carolina, where he was the only person in his school who wasn't white. His parents are from India. Let's start with a short excerpt of Intimate Moments for a Sensual Evening.
I like living in L.A. One thing I don't like about living here is driving. I always get bored when I'm driving. And when I get bored, I go on the internet on my BlackBerry. So I'm gonna die. And whenever they go through the records, they'll find my phone and be like, whoa, that's what he looked up right before he died? I'm gonna be so sad. I'll be like, comedian Aziz Ansari was killed in a car accident today. He was struck by another vehicle while using IMDb to see if Val Kilmer was indeed in the film Willow. Representatives for Mr. Kilmer confirm he was indeed in the film and hopes this will prevent future tragedies of this nature. This is the third Willow-related death this year. Comedian Aziz Ansari was killed in a car accident today. He was struck by another vehicle while checking showtimes for Up on Fandango. He just purchased a single ticket for a 4 o'clock show at a $2 theater in order to live out the saddest afternoon of all time. Comedy bad boy Aziz Ansari, a.k.a. comedy heartthrob Aziz Ansari, was killed in an awful automobile accident today. He was struck by another vehicle while Googling his own name.
That's Aziz Ansari from his comedy special, which is now on DVD, called Intimate Moments for a Sensual Evening. Aziz Ansari, welcome back to Fresh Air. That is really funny. What made you think about how embarrassing it would be to die while Googling yourself?
Well, I remember when I used to come out to L.A. for months at a time when we were doing this sketch comedy show I was on called Human Giant, and I didn't have GPS or anything, and I would be in rental cars, and I would be on my BlackBerry looking at maps at, like, the dumbest stuff, like using the Wendy's restaurant locator and things like that, and I was like, this is so dumb. I'm gonna die because I'm on my phone looking for a Wendy's. And so from that notion, I kind of came up with the other bits for that joke.
Your act is filled with the kinds of stories that you would tell friends, but you're telling the audience. Are friends sometimes your first audience?
Sometimes, like, you know, I've told stories to friends and been like, oh, you know, I could probably take that story and turn it into something in my act. Like, after I went and saw that R. Kelly story, I obviously told some friends about that experience as a friend telling someone about something crazy that happened to him. And then I started doing it on stage and kind of crafting it more for stand-up purposes. And, you know, when you tell a story on stage, it's a different thing. You kind of have to have, you know, really hard jokes to go in, and the pacing and stuff has to be right. So it takes, you know, it'll take a while for me to tell a story on stage to get it to where it really works well stand-up-wise. But, yeah, you know, all those things I've talked about in my act, for the most part, like the story about Kanye West and stuff, those are all stories I told my friends at some point, you know.
So I want to play another example from your show. That's now out on DVD and CD. And in this part, you're talking about watching a reality show on MTV called Next. It's a reality show about dating that I've actually never seen or heard of. But you had previously done a sketch comedy show as part of the group Human Giant on MTV. So
yes.
Here's your take on this dating reality show.
First guy that comes out, right? He's a guy going out on the dates. And he comes up there and he says this. He goes, yo, this girl better be pretty, because if she's a pain in the ass, I'm going to need something cute to look at. And I was stunned that he could say that. That's so offensive. And at the same time, on my show, they didn't want us to say that a character was raped by a dinosaur. Raped by a dinosaur, because that's too offensive. Oh, I guess they didn't want all these angry letters from paleontologists. We're like, hey, man, there's nothing in the fossil records to suggest that kind of behavior. So why don't you chill with your accusations? And then after you meet this dude, then you meet the girls he's going out on the dates with. And they come up there and they say things like, if he has a neck tattoo, I'm going to lick it. It's like, whoa, how slutty can you be in 5 seconds? And then after they say that, they freeze. And like 3 facts about them pop up on the left side. And the first 2 facts are always really normal. But the third fact always comes way out of left field. It's always like, Monica's 22. She's a hairdresser in Hollywood. And she hates purple gift wrap. Like, how does that define her as a person? And the whole show just bummed me out, man. Because the things they try to keep off TV are just like really explicit sex or violence. And no one cares about their kids seeing attitudes like that on TV. And that's way worse to me. Like, I'd much rather have a daughter that grew up and shot me in the leg and burned my house down than some really slutty girl that hates the sound of people eating bananas.
Are you amazed at how proud people are to behave stupidly on reality TV shows?
Man, every time I've seen that show Next, you really can't believe how terrible the people are that go on that show. What if each time you came back from a clip, I was just sitting here just laughing so hard at my own stuff? <It's> like, Oh, God, Terry, we got to take a break. I forgot about that bit. It's so funny. And you're like, oh, my God, this guy's really full of himself.
So do you feel like you had to create a personality, like a persona for yourself on stage, like a stage version of Aziz Ansari?
No, not really. I never made a conscious effort to do that. I just kind of tried to be kind of natural and conversational, and I think my stuff is kind of a little bit longer, more story-based. It's not as jokey sometimes, you know? I just try to create, like, a vibe of, someone kind of casually telling you stories and things like that.
Now, you did create an alter ego comedian named Randy, which you portrayed in Funny People, and there's some really funny, you can find these on YouTube, really funny video.
Wait, you're not going to play any excerpts from the
Randy? Oh, they're
the
so filthy. There's like absolutely no word I could probably play on the radio.
Wait, can you say tatties? That's not even a real world. That's a word that Randy made up, tatties.
Right.
You can say tat. Let's just both say tatty. Terry, can you just say tatties real quick just to do it?
Oh, no, I would never say that word.
But that's not a real word.
I know.
Randy made up that word.
I know.
You could say it.
You're going to make me
say it. Would be a landmark moment for NPR if you just said tatties one time. It's not a real word. They don't have to bleep it. It's an imaginary word.
Put it in a sentence for me.
Look at those tatties. They got to let this on, please. They're definitely not going to put any of it on NPR.
Okay, imaginary scenario. 4-year-old says to his mother, Mommy, what's a tatty?
And she'll be like, I don't know. Is that something you heard on NPR?
Then it must mean an intellectual endeavor involving...
Tatties refers to a rare form of violin playing that was practiced in ancient Denmark.
Thank you. Tatties, that's among my favorite type of music.
You said tatties.
There
you did
go.
It. You did.
So tell us how you created your alter ego, Randy. Who is Randy? Randy.
So Randy was a character in the film Funny People that was the last film Judd Apatow did, and he had this character, and he there's very little bit of stuff written.
It's
for
a,
Randy.
It's a film about stand up comics, and you play
yes.
one of them. Yeah. Who's
yes, and Randy was a small character, and the idea Judd kind of pitched to me was that he wanted the guy to be, like, really cocky and, like, very concerned about things like merchandising and things like that. So that was kind of the basic idea. And the other notion in my head all the time was, like, okay, every time I've done comedy in, like, traditional comedy clubs, there's always these comedians that do really well with audiences but that the other comedians hate because they're just, you know, doing kind of cheapy stuff, like dancing around or doing like very kind of base sex humor a lot and stuff like that. So I kind of took that idea and ran with that as well. And you know, I watched a lot of comedians like, you know, I really like this comedian Cat Williams, and you know, he's very energetic and you know, he's really funny. But I saw that and I was like, well, what if somebody just saw that and it just was like, oh, I can do that. It's just like yelling around and saying stuff about your penis and did it badly. And that's another kind of thing about Randy that I kind of took.
And it's great. His DJ is called Ole Youngun.
That's this guy Brandon Johnson, who's very funny. I was at the UCB Theater in LA. It's a theater I perform in, and I was kind of workshopping the Randy material. Like, once we had the Randy character, the idea of it, I was at first just kind of doing my material and just kind of, you know, jumping around and yelling it in different ways and stuff. And then, you know, as we were filming, I was like, well, I should just write specific material for Randy because Randy wouldn't talk about the stuff Aziz talks about. So that's when I kind of wrote this stuff about, you know, the really dirtier stuff. And one night I had this idea of like, oh, well, Randy should have a DJ. And so I loaded up my laptop with like these sounds like, a lot of DJs and hip-hop artists, when you see them perform live, they will have this reggaeton horn sample that just goes, bah, 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 and rap artists use it, like, to death. And it's just like, anytime you go see a rap show, they, like, hit that thing way too much. Like, they'll just be like, you guys psyched to be here, like, bah, 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 bah. So I was like, well, what if a comedian used that sound, too, the same way rappers do? So I wrote that, and I had, like, I recorded myself just going, Randy! Just like that. And so, like, my idea was, like, whenever I would do a joke at the end, it would just be like, and then I was like, I gotta get out of here. Randy! And, you know, so that was the idea. And I was just gonna keep the laptop on the side of the stage, and then after I finished the joke, like, jump over and just start hitting those buttons like crazy. So, like, I would finish a joke, and there'd just be like, Randy! You know, like that. And, my friend Brandon was there, and I was like, oh, Brandon's really funny. What if he's just the DJ? And so he did it, and, like, right away, I could tell he was just going to be awesome at this. And so every time I did Randy after that, he was there.
My guest is comic and actor Aziz Ansari. His Comedy Central special just came out on CD and DVD. Ansari co-stars on the NBC series Parks and Recreation. Amy Poehler plays the head of the Parks and Rec Department in a small Indiana town. Ansari plays Tom Haverford, one of the people who works for her in the department. Let's hear a scene. Poehler has just been trying to convert a big pit into a park. She started a community garden in the pit.
People have just really embraced this and planted the coolest stuff. And Tom is our master horticulturist. He knows all the scientific names for everything, right, Tom?
Yep.
Like this? What's this, Tom?
Those are, of course, tomatoes, or Soulja Boy tellos. Whenever Leslie asks me for the Latin names of any of our plants, I just give her the names of rappers.
And those over there?
Those are some ditties. We have some Bone Thugs and Harmoniums right here.
Growing beautifully.
Those ludicruses are coming in great.
A lot of people know you from the TV series Parks and Recreation.
Yes, we just got picked up for a third season, which I'm very excited about.
Congratulations. Describe your character.
In the show, I play a character named Tom Haverford, who is a lower-level employee at the Parks and Recreation Department in a small town called Pawnee, Indiana. And I work under Amy Poehler's character, Leslie Knope, and it's a really fun character. You know, he's kind of like this guy who thinks he's really cool, but he's stuck in this small town, and he's just way cooler and smoother in his head than he actually is. You know, I kind of, the kind of people that I think about when I'm portraying the character, I'm like, well, who's this guy's hero? And for some reason, Jamie Foxx, it always pops in my head. Like, I think Jamie Foxx is, like, who he really looks up to because, you know, Jamie's an Oscar winner, he's an R&B singer, and he's an all-around smooth guy.
Now, one of the things that happens to your character in Parks and Recreation is something that I imagine happens to you as well. People who meet the character assume that he must be from India, even though he actually was born and grew up in South Carolina, like you. And he has changed his name to Tom Haverford from Darwish Sabir Ismail Ghani.
It's Darwish Sabir Ismail Ghani, yeah.
Yeah.
So, which is my cousin's name.
Oh, yeah. You always talk about your cousin Darwish. I didn't realize that was his full name.
I put his name on there just so he would watch it and freak out.
Did he freak out?
Yeah. He was like, man, all these people just started emailing me and say, use my name in the show.
So here's a scene from a party in which you and the Leslie Knope's character she's there with her boyfriend, and you and she are trying to impress him. He assumes you're from India.
God, India is so amazing. Let me tell you something. That is my absolute favorite place to travel. Where did you say your parents were from?
The South Park.
Ugh, the southern part's always the best part of anything.
Have you ever been to Kunaman Mosque down in Tamil Nadu?
Are you kidding? My uncle practically runs the place. I prayed there. It's sick.
Tell me everything right now.
One sec.
I just gotta hit the loo, as those bastard British imperialists would say. Last time I was in India, I was 8 years old, and I stayed inside the whole time playing video games. I gotta bone up. Fourth largest coal reserves in the world.
What you're doing is you're in another room at the computer boning up by Googling or going on Wikipedia or something so that you can answer his questions. Sounds smart.
Yeah, that was a funny bit they wrote. I thought that was really funny because I always meet white people that know way more about India than I do and have probably spent more time in India than I have. And it always cracks me up because, like, people assume I know a lot, and it's like, no, I don't really. I haven't been there that much. You know, I've been there two or three times, and, you know, it's not something I'm proud of. I wish I knew more and wish I'd spent more time there, but, you know, I haven't, you know? Yeah, I thought that was kind of a smart bit that they put in there for me to do in the show. Yeah.
So did your parents immigrate here from India?
Yes, yeah. My parents are from India, but I was born and raised in South Carolina.
And you were the only person in your school up to 10th grade who was not white, right?
Yes, I went to this small school in Bennettsville, South Carolina, where I'm from. There's like, you know, 9,000 people there. And yeah, I was the only minority in the whole school. There wasn't even any Asian people, nothing. And then in 11th and 12th grade, I went to this school called the Governor School for Science and Math, which is like this public boarding school where they kind of take kids that are advanced in science and math. Geniuses, such as myself. I went there in 11th and 12th grade, and there I finally saw an Asian person for the first time ever. And, you know, that school, it was much more racially diverse, and I met people of different backgrounds and stuff. And also, even just meeting kids from different parts of South Carolina was good because, you know, everyone in Bennettsville is from Bennettsville and, like, talks like people from Bennettsville, et cetera. In the Governor School, I met some people that are from, like, Greenville and Columbia and Charleston and Somerville, which are, you know, compared to Bennettsville, may as well be, like, New York or L.A., you know, because Bennettsville is kind of a small, you know, bubble. But, you know, that's kind of where I lost my Southern accent and stuff like that, and it was a good experience. But, yes, when I was growing up in Bennettsville, I was the only non-white kid in the whole school. But I think when people hear that, they immediately think, like, wow, that must have been horrible. Like, people threw stuff at you every day, and it was horribly racist. And it really wasn't. Like, occasionally, I was telling someone this the other day, like, occasionally there was, like, a racist thing that happened every now and then. But for the majority of the time, I may as well have just been a really tan white kid. You know, I may as well have just been like a fat kid. You know, sure, every now and then people make fun of you for being fat, but most of the time people are just like, all right, that's the way it is.
So we're going to squeeze in one more clip here.
Sure.
Here's another clip from Aziz Ansari's Comedy Central special that's now out on DVD and CD. And this is something that is in part talking about movies. I don't think I really need to set it up, though.
I was doing an interview once, and this guy goes, you must be pretty psyched by all this Slumdog Millionaire stuff. And I was like, yeah, I am. I have no idea why, though. I had nothing to do with that movie. It's just some people that kind of look like me are in this movie that everyone loves and winning Oscars and stuff. And I was like, whoa. Are white people just psyched all the time? It's like, Back to the Future, that's us. Godfather, that's us. Godfather Part 2, that's us. Departed, that's us. Sunset Boulevard, that's us. Citizen Kane, that's us. Jaws, that's us. Every f-ing movie but Slumdog Millionaire and Boys in the Hood is us.
You had to bleep my favorite punchline at the end of that joke.
Well, what can I say? So is that a good summation of what you think of, like, identity politics?
When I crafted that joke, I wasn't doing it in the idea of, like, what is my you know, statement on identity politics, but I think that that is really how I felt. Like, I don't think that guy, when he asked that question, was being racist or anything when he said, are you psyched about Slumdog Millionaire? Because the answer is yes, and it's actually very interesting to me. Like, why are people psyched about that? Why do I get psyched that that movie's doing well? I had nothing to do with it. Why is there that kind of sense of, like, camaraderie with people that are just happen to be of the same ethnicity as me? And then, you know, then from that, I took the idea of, like, well, I mean, what I'm really saying is, oh, so I guess white people don't have that because they're so everywhere and so successful. I guess the reason you do get excited is because, oh, you don't really see a lot of Indian people doing Oscar-winning movies. So when you see that, you feel kind of proud, I guess. But, you know, so if that was true for white people, they'd be psyched all the time because every movie has white people in it, you know.
Aziz Ansari, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aziz Ansari's Comedy Central special is now on DVD and CD. It's called Intimate Moments for a Sensual Evening. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Sunday's Super Bowl, it's a pretty safe bet that one of two men will be vilified in their home cities, Indianapolis Colts coach Jim Caldwell or New Orleans Saints coach Sean Payton. When a team loses, fans always find a way to blame the coach. We're used to seeing NFL coaches roaming the sidelines during games, talking into headsets, yelling at referees, and encouraging their players. But it occurred to us that being an NFL coach is actually an interesting management job. He has to supervise 100 or so assistant coaches and staff, motivate 53 players with big salaries and egos, handle intense media scrutiny, and accept the fact that he will be adored or reviled every week, depending on how his team plays on Sunday. To find out what it's like, we turn to Brian Billick, who spent 9 seasons as head coach of the Baltimore Ravens. He won a Super Bowl in his second year on the job and was eventually fired when the team performed poorly. He's now a television commentator for Fox Sports and the NFL Network and author of the book More Than a Game. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Brian Billick, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's hard to think of another job where you work 7 days a week, you know, 80, 90, 100 hours a week, you know, sleep in your office, live on coffee and caffeine, and work around the clock. But you're really judged by what happens in 3.5 hours on Sunday when the game occurs. Does it make you a little crazy, that kind of a job?
You know, sometimes you tend to think of it in those terms, and you got to remember, you know, everybody has a tough job. Everybody has tough hours. But the hardest thing is that when that first whistle blows in July, late July, when you start training camp, particularly a head coach will not have a day, not a single day off from the very beginning of training camp at the end of the July till hopefully early February if you're making a Super Bowl run. And it's that constant, incessant clock that is always going off. I mean, you're used to long hours and everybody works hard. But that clock stops for no one, and that's the one that can kind of grind you down if you're not careful.
Well, I wanted to talk about the intensity of game day for an NFL coach. And I thought we'd listen to a little montage of some coaches caught on game day.
Come here. Hey, don't wait for him to catch it. Run through his Don't wait for him to catch it. You there. That's an NFL play right there. Make it. Yes, sir.
Can anybody give me any idea why they're running up and down the field? Can anybody give me that? Anytime we call a blitz, we're going one way, they find a hole on the other side. What is that?
When that guy takes off, go get him. You got to make that play. That guy runs like me, man. You can make that play.
We're going to throw a damn touchdown because your boy ran right by the damn guy if you block your damn man. Grow up.
You got to protect him. We can't have that happen, especially not down in the red zone. All right? So now listen, the mark of a pro, you got to go play. Let it go. Go play.
Jay. Hey, my headset's up again.
What's it doing?
I don't know. No one hears me. Jay.
And that's some NFL coaches, among them Mike Tomlin, Mike Singletary, and at the end, the volatile John Gruden complaining about his headset not working. And that's one of the first questions I wanted to ask you, Brian Billick. Every NFL coach has a headset all game. What are you guys hearing and saying within that headset?
Well, boy, you want to make some money? Put that thing on live, you know, tape that and play it. Some of the conversations would be enlightening. Of course, you'd have to edit. It could only go on the internet. You couldn't even put it on cable. It's so laden with profanities and tirades, and you know, it's an interesting combination of, particularly for the head coach. Everybody has a headset on for the communication purposes. You have 4 or 5 coaches up in the booth that obviously have that perspective. Then you've got all the coaches along the sideline, the position coaches, the coordinators, that basically it's just a communication process of communicating with one another of what's going on. And everybody has a responsibility on a given play to look at a different aspect of what's going on. You want to hear a coach go off, and I am infamous, I should say, among my assistant coaches for if I had a question, because let's say offensively, okay, the running back coach is supposed to watch the exchange between the quarterback and the running back and the drop of the quarterback. One line coach is supposed to watch the point of attack, and the other line coach is supposed to watch the backside of the play. The receiver coach is maybe supposed to watch the rotation of the secondary. And it's hard to do because you tend to want to, almost like a fan, watch the play. And so something would happen, and I'd get on the phone and say, you know, maybe there was an exchange problem or the quarterback got sacked and I was worried about the depth of the drop. And I'd click on and say, okay, did he get his full drop? And if the coach didn't have the right answer, you know, if he was – coach, I wasn't watching, boy, I would go off. I mean, you know, nothing would irritate me more. And I'd call this guy – basically to get everybody else online going – you don't want to be the next guy that tells me I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. And it's just all about the communication with one another. And it's in a heated environment. You don't have the time. You would love to, whether it be player or coach, after a difficulty, a crisis, to, as they come off the field, say, you know, put a big warm fuzzy arm around them and say, gee, you know what? I don't know that that was the most efficient or expeditious way to accomplish that. Why don't we sit down and let's talk about and analyze? You don't have time for that. So it's the 2x4 to the head going, you stupid so-and-so, what, you know, what did you see or what happened or why did you do that? And because you've got to cut to the chase of it. But it's part of that process that you develop the rapport with the players to understand, look, nobody should take offense to the demeanor or the tone of the way we communicate during the game. We've got to cut to the chase, and if need be, we'll apologize for it afterward.
You know, I've done a little bit of sports reporting, and what's really striking about if you've watched football or really any other sport from up above where there's this majestic sort of ballet-like quality to it is that when you get down on the field level, you realize how incredibly fast it happens and how quick these highly conditioned athletes are. And for some of the seasons that you coached, I know that you didn't just monitor what was going. You actually called every offensive play, which means you have this paper in front of you with all these complex formations. And I wonder if you could just kind of take us through the speed at which this happens. I mean, because, you know, when a play is run, your running back runs for 2 yards, he's tackled. The referee spots the ball, and in 45 seconds, they have to snap another play, right?
Yeah.
So take us through what you do as a coach to make that happen, to get the next play in.
Yeah, the excellent question, because I think that's probably the one thing that fans don't have a full appreciation for, because it is. You sit up in the stadiums and you have that particular viewpoint. You're wondering, well, why did that guy throw the ball there? You know, can he see? Well, you know, probably not. I think fans would be amazed to see the speed of the game, particularly, say, from the quarterback position. They'd be amazed at how little the quarterback really can see when he throws the ball or what he's doing. But think about it. In that 40-second time, just by way of example, the ball's placed. You have to take into account where are we, what's the down, the distance, the field position, what's our intent, where are we in the game, where are we on the field. You've got to get the right personnel. I've got to orchestrate 11 people. First, I've got to get the right 11 people on the field. I then have got to give them the parameters as to what we're doing. Where do they line up? Where are they going? How do they communicate with one another? That has to be communicated to the quarterback. He then, in turn, has to turn around and communicate it to the team. You then have to get those 11 guys up on the line of scrimmage with all the shifting and motioning and whatever you may do and get the ball snapped and get everybody on the same page doing the same thing. And you're making calculations as a coach in terms of what it is you want to call, what it is you're trying to accomplish, where you are in the game. It's a very, very fast-paced, and it's not something that's done very easily.
So you have – that leaves you with what, 8 seconds to make a decision about what the next play is going to be?
Yeah, you don't have much time. That's you really have to be a play ahead. You know, as the play's being run as a play caller, you pretty much have to have in mind, okay, if this gets stoned and we get nothing, then I'm going to do A. If we get a first down, I'm going to do B. If we get an explosive play out of this, I'm going to do C. I mean, the parameters of where – what the result of that play may be that will dictate your next call are – you know, can fathom you at some point in terms of the choices that you have. So you better – you know, you've got to be that proverbial 2 and 3 steps ahead or you're forever going to be that 1 step behind.
And so you yell a play which will sound something like shotgun solo right close Z left to jet rattle wide drag.
Yeah, and it all is supposed to. And we coaches, I got to tell you, we coaches can make it a little more complex than we should. And with the advent of the coach to quarterback communicator, you know, before you had to be very brief because you had to signal it in.
Right. Explain that for the audience. I mean, right.
Well, before, about 10 years ago, eight to 10 years ago, we added what only made sense, the ability for the play caller to, via a microphone in the quarterback's head, give him the play directly. Prior to that, it was a little like baseball managers signaling, you know, the pitch or the steal sign. You had to go through this intricate orchestrated dance of signaling in the personnel, the formation, and the play. And obviously, so you didn't look like you were out there having an epileptic fit, you had to be as concise as possible. So everything was about verbiage that the players could be signaled in relatively quickly that met these multiple things. And it put a lot on the players to remember, you know, if I signal in waggle right, that means these five different things. Well, once we got the communicator in, it meant that you could communicate all these things directly. So what used to be I write 22, you know, because that was easy to get in and you expected the players to know the I meant this right to the tight end, a motion was built in and 22 is an even number and therefore it's a zone play and therefore we do. You expected the players to know it. Now you can send in Tiger personnel, I write Z short, 22 zone, X crack, backside chip. You know, you could tell virtually everybody what to do. And so we got, you know, kind of drawn into where now the play calling, as you read there out of the book, becomes this multiple, you know, foreign language sounding multi-dimensional call that Dave basically tells all 11 players what to do on every single play, and the verbiage can be overwhelming at times.
Now, another thing people will notice when they watch a game is that the coach will have in his hand like a big play sheet, maybe laminated for the weather, but that when they actually call the play into their headset, they hold the sheet up so as to hide their mouth. Are you guys really worried about lip readers or something?
Yeah, we're not a paranoid group, are we? Because obviously there's a mass infusion of lip reading in the National Football League, which is kind of silly. I think it bore out from the point that I don't know that anybody can actually read your lips, but what they might be able to glean is whether it's a run or pass based on the length of the call.
Uh-huh.
So again, we are tend to be a paranoid group as coaches. So it's almost out of habit now, as much as anything. I remember during a game one time, we had a timeout, and I'm standing there talking to the quarterback, and I figure he's blocking off the view from the opponent. So we're just talking about our options, and I was calling a particular play, and the guy up in the booth was yelling, "Coach, you got to change the play. You got to change the play." I'm going, "What do you mean I got to change the play? What's wrong with the play I called?" He said, "They had you up on the Jumbotron, and they could see every word you were saying on the other sideline." So of which after the game, obviously, I had a long conversation with our guy that runs the Jumbotron, rather one-sided conversation, I might add. But, yeah, so we tend to be a little more paranoid with it and probably take it to extremes.
You wrote in the book that that players and coaches fundamentally are motivated by different things. I mean, the coach will be judged on whether or not his team wins, but the player is motivated by the kind of contract they get that will be governed by their individual statistics. So you must have situations where the team is doing well, but a running back or a wide receiver you have isn't getting the ball enough and is going to get unhappy. How do you deal with that?
And that is the toughest scenario because, as we talked about in the book, you know, you follow the money. You know, greed is good because it's quite a motivator. And that's probably the biggest disconnect between coaches and players. And that's not to say that players don't want to win. Don't get me wrong. But you've got to find the core motivation. At the end of the day, that next contract's going to be dictated by their individual performance. You could lose every single game, but if this kid leads the league in sacks, he's going to get a pretty good contract. And we can have stats up the yazoo and lead the league in offense and defense, but if I don't win enough games, then I'm not going to be around as a coach. So the wins and losses are what dictates my contract and how much money I'm going to make. So there is a bit of a disconnect. But the scenario you're talking about is very difficult because – and it's very easy to dismiss it because if you're doing well as a team, but you have an individual that's maybe not getting his touches, as we say, it's hard for him to publicly complain because then he just looks selfish. But that doesn't mean privately he's not being bothered by it and he's not emotionally wearing himself out because he goes home and he hears from his wife or his girlfriend or his mother or
his
whoever.
Agent.
Or his agent, heck, how come you're not? How come coach isn't using you more? How come you're not getting this more or that? And you get beat up with it.
It is a violent game, and over the course of a season, players that aren't injured enough to be taken out of the game do get bruises and sores and nicks. And I'm wondering how you deal with that as a head coach, because there may be situations where players want to play more than they should, or don't want to play, and you think they can take on more. And how you – I mean, do you give them less practice? Do you make them practice less with pads? Do you make them rest more when they don't want to?
Well, there's been a renaissance in the league over the last 10, 15 years to where coaches have finally recognized the cumulative hits, the physical demand that these players are under. It used to be old school. I'm old enough. God forbid we're used to – well, don't give them water. That'll prove how tough they are. You know, how stupid is that? I mean, there's physiological needs, but that was the mentality before. Or we're going to practice in pads every single day and we're just going to be tougher than our opponent. Well, all you're going to do is beat yourself up. You know, Bill Walsh, who I was with in San Francisco and was probably the originator to a large degree of the concepts that, the body can only take so many hits. And our job, and I remember him constantly telling the coaches, your job, even in training camp, is to get the players to the opening game healthy and fresh. That's job one. Now, we have a lot of the things we got to get done. We got to get ready for the games. We got to integrate the offense, the defense. We got to get them in physical shape. We got to get them in hitting shape. But we need our players to be there healthy and fresh. What good is it if we beat them up in practice to where the less than 100% player shows up to play? And that has changed the mentality of coaches to where almost universally in the NFL, by the time you get to midseason, most teams have pulled the pads off. You cut down the practice time. I remember when I first got to Minnesota, the legendary Bud Grant, who was known for, no shirt, no long sleeves out in that winter and, the players playing in the elements. And when I just got there, they had built a new indoor facility. And I remember Bud Grant telling me, he says, that's the worst thing you could ever do is to practice on that indoor facility. And I'm thinking, well, okay, this is the typical, you need to be out in the elements and whatever, as you would expect from a Bud Grant in up in the Northland. And it was, no, that's not the reason for it. He says, cold's cold. I don't care if you're used to it or not. Cold is cold. He says, the mistake is that because you can go indoors in a more protected, warm environment, you're now going to practice longer than you should in November and December. He says, the best thing for us is it was so cold here. We'd get out there in November and December in Minnesota, and you couldn't last more than 45 minutes to an hour, so we had to shorten practice, which was better for the players.
I remember you as an emotional coach. I mean, you had a lot to say, and I think you write in the book that you were fined $75,000 over the years for comments that you made to the media. Are you a calmer man now?
I'm poor, that's for sure. By about $75,000, that'll get your attention now. Part of it is, and I truly believe that your fans and your players need to know that this is important to you. It's one thing to have a cool demeanor, which you need to have, and it always needs to be calculated to a certain degree. But as coaches, football coaches, we don't have home plate to kick dirt on like baseball managers. At some point, the fans need to see you upset, defending their honor, defending your team. The players need to see you defending them, so to speak. And that emotion, you expect them to be emotional. always under control but emotional. But you do learn that you need to temper it a little bit. Certainly I've said my fair share of stupid things that have shown up in a way that you don't fully appreciate until you do become a head coach. You don't realize how many people are looking at you and how that organization, that city, your players react to you as the head coach. Is something you have to learn as a head coach.
Well, can you recall one of those things that got you fined that
Memorable? Typically it had to do with criticisms of official. I'm not a big fan of replay, and I remember after one particular replay that I did not think was appropriate.
That's where the officials will look at video and sometimes overturn a call on the field.
Correct. Right? They'll review it on the film, and they do this dog and pony show and go and look at this peep show booth and come out and tell you they were right or wrong. And after the game, and it was a game we won, I said, again, I don't know what I think Johnny Greer was the official that did the particular review, and it did not go the way that then you look at the film and in your opinion is wrong. I had said after the game, I said, I don't know what Johnny's doing when he's looking in that little peephole booth. For all I know, he's looking at pictures of his grandkids because he couldn't have been looking at the play because he was wrong. And, well, the league didn't want to hear that and fine me for it. So, and rightfully so. They've got to make sure that the officials can operate within a safe environment, so to speak. And you don't have the right to be demeaning or to belittle someone. And the officials are usually pretty good at it. They're going to let you kind of go off to a certain degree, but then they realize when you reach that point and they'll give you that look that, okay, if you want to go beyond this, then there's going to be repercussions. But if you'll stop now, everything's cool. And you'll learn to play that game a little bit better as a head coach, the longer you're the head coach and the more fines you've paid.
I read that in the 2000 season, which was your championship run, that during the season you forbade players from using the words playoff or Super Bowl and even fined one of them, Tony Siragusa, for violating it. Is that true?
Yeah, it was interesting. Keep in mind, when I came to the Baltimore Ravens, they had not had a winning season since their inception. And they had some good football players. They had a number of players that had gone to the Pro Bowl. But I had made it very clear, at some point, if you're going to be a team, a good team, a championship team, you've got to decide what your priorities are. Is it more important to go to the Pro Bowl or to a Super Bowl? And once we started to get on a run and started to be a team that could think of themselves that way, I wanted to challenge the players that, look, you got to earn the right to think of yourself as a playoff team, to call yourself a playoff team. And until that happens, you haven't earned that yet. So that's the carrot. Go earn the right to be thought of as a playoff team, even to the point. And we had kind of some fun with it, the kangaroo court of okay, we can't use the word playoff, which made it very interesting because as we got close to it, the league, once you become within legitimate striking distance of making the playoffs, allow the organizations, particularly those that have the chance of having a home playoff game, to start selling playoff tickets because administratively, financially, you just need to do that. So I put my organization in a bit of a bind because I forbade the use of the word playoff, and here they had to sell playoff tickets. So they had to come up with – I think they used the term as an old Seinfeld episode. They made up a term, Festivus Maximus. And that was what we called it because they didn't want to, incur the wrath of the head coach and be fined for using the word playoff. And it was kind of fun, and the players picked up on it. And so when I think it was we had beat the San Diego Chargers and had a couple games left in the season actually and actually qualified for the playoffs, we removed the ban on the P word because we were now a playoff team.
Yeah, well, if you hadn't spent 100 hours a week watching film and doing other coaching tasks, you would have known that Festivus was a substitute for Christmas in a Seinfeld episode.
It served our purpose, so what the heck.
Got a Super Bowl Sunday. What do you expect is going to happen?
Fascinating game. It's going to be a shootout. It could be a real track meet. Now, having said that, it'll be 6-3 and prove me wrong, but both these teams dynamic offenses, two of the best quarterbacks probably to ever play the game, clearly in Peyton Manning and probably in Drew Brees. This is going to be a shootout. Could be lots of fun.
And I have to ask you on behalf of many, many friends, when are we ever going to get rid of the Gatorade shower for the coach at the end? How did you feel about that?
Oh, you don't want to do that. That's very profitable. That pays very well. I got to tell you, that shows up on commercials a lot, and they got to pay you for that. So as a coach, no, bring it on. Pour that Gatorade on. But it's kind of a traditional thing. How do you get rid of tradition?
You felt it a few times. Did you ever try and dodge it?
You know what? It was interesting. In our Super Bowl game, it was fun because, you know, it's rare that you have a chance to really, while you're in the moment, step aside and realize what's going on. And in the fourth quarter of our Super Bowl 35, you knew we were going to win. The game was in hand. And so you have a chance to really kind of take it all in. And I remember grabbing Matt Cavanaugh, who was my offensive coordinator's son, Andrew, was kind of a ball boy for us. And it's great when you can have the kids around that way. And I grabbed Andrew about the middle of that fourth quarter, and I said, and the security guy that was responsible for me, and I said, Andrew, I want you to go around and empty out all the Gatorade buckets, okay? And I told the security guy, if I get Gatorade poured on me, you're fired, okay? They both bailed on me immediately. But because it is kind of a rite of passage and really something as a coach, although it was cold that night and I really didn't want to get wet. But it was one of those things that you really do, you look back on and you do treasure because it is that rite of passage and signifies something very special.
Well, Brian Billick, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to do it.
Brian Billick spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Billick won a Super Bowl the second year he coached the Baltimore Ravens. He's now a commentator for Fox Sports and the NFL Network and is the author of the book More Than a Game.